This is the second aspect of the third section of England's dreaming. I move on to talk about Trust of Homes, and particularly the problem of bright line development in Lloyds, Bank and Rosset, by which I mean the problem of trying to introduce strict rules where otherwise equity has always held sway. I'm going to focus particularly on the retreat from Lord Bridge's test in Lloyds, Bank and Rosset. The test that Lord Bridge laid down in Lloyds, Bank and Rosset was as follows. You acquired rights in your home either if there had been some agreement, arrangement or understanding between the parties so as to form a common intention between them, and if that agreement, arrangement or understanding had been reached before the date of acquisition or exceptionally at some later date, and if the claimant had suffered detriment of some sort. Or alternatively, you could acquire a right in your home if you had either contributed to the purchase price for that property or you had paid the mortgage instalments. It's, quote, at least extremely doubtful whether anything less will do. Thus we have this slightly troublesome notion of common intention developing, begun in cases like Pettit and Pettit and Gissing, flowing through Lloyds, Bank and Rosset, still not resolved by the House of Lords and Stack and Dowden. Now, I say there's a retreat from Lloyds, Bank and Rosset, because even though there's an exceptional clarity in Lord Bridge's test, as I've just set it out, and even though his lordship clearly wants to merge constructive trust and proprietary estoppel together into one large doctrine, cases subsequently simply have not followed that clear test. So we've got the cases that I refer to as the balance sheet cases in chapter 15 of my textbook Equity and Trusts, where Springett and Defoe and Huntingford and Hobbes are both clearly based on resulting trust, which is not something, not a concept, which Lord Bridge mentions, even though his idea of contributing to the purchase price would ordinarily have been understood by the rest of us as being a resulting trust. So we've got those balance sheet cases. They're about resulting trust. They're only concerned with the money that's been contributed to the acquisition of property. We have another stream of cases I've called the family assets cases, Hammond and Mitchell, Middlebank and Cook, where Mr. Justice, latterly Lord Justice Waite, is concerned to undertake a survey of the whole course of dealing, starting with a presumption of equality between the parties, just as a family law judge of that era would have done. We then have more recent cases which are concerned with avoiding unconscionability in general terms. So we've got the Court of Appeal in Jennings and Rice, Mr. Justice Mann in Cox and Jones, Court in Crossley and Crossley, and in Turner and Jacob, all of them concerned with avoiding the claimant suffering any unconscionability by being denied an interest in the home. Most recently, Lord Justice Chadwick in Oxley and Hiscock has been concerned with fairness and with supplying the party's common intention. Let me give you the following passage from Lord Justice Chadwick's judgment. Quote, what the court is doing in cases of this nature is to supply or impute a common intention as to the party's respective shares, in circumstances in which there was in fact no common intention, on the basis of that which, in the light of all the material circumstances, including the acts and conduct of the parties after the acquisition, is shown to be fair. And it may be more satisfactory to accept that there is no difference in cases of this nature between constructive trust and proprietary estoppel. In my book, Mark Thompson's case note in the 2005 Conveyancer, Simon Gardner in the 2004 Law Quarterly Review, much doubt is then cast on how Lord Justice Chadwick attempts to reconcile all the early authorities. That's not what I want to focus on here. The problem with this test in Oxley, it seems to me, is that it is pointlessly fictitious. This is not a test based on common intention at all. The court is not looking for the parties' common intention here, by which we should mean a meeting of minds, which only the parties themselves can reach. But rather the court is supplying that common intention. The court is making that common intention up. On what basis are they doing this? We need the judges to own up to the ideas which are actually propelling their thinking. For example, the reference to fairness in Lord Justice Chadwick's judgment is an idea we used to find in the old judgments of Lord Denning, which created the, quote, deserted wife's equity that his lordship was so keen on. And this is something which should concern us. Lord Denning, for example, was concerned only to help wives, and we must be concerned as to how he might have treated women whom he considered less deserving. In his memoir, The Due Process of Law, published in 1980, his lordship let us in on his personal vision of the war between the sexes, and I quote, No matter how you may dispute and argue, you cannot alter the fact that women are different from men. The principal task in life of women is to bear and rear children, and it is a task which occupies the best years of their lives. The man's part in bringing up the children is no doubt as important as hers, but of necessity he cannot devote so much time to it. He is physically the stronger, and she the weaker. He is temperamentally the more aggressive, and she the more submissive. It is he who takes the initiative, and she who responds. And it goes on in this vein for some little while. Now, if we knew that this was the thinking which was underpinning the allocation of rights in the home, we might be less confident in the use of an idea of fairness. And yet, the majority judicial opinion currently is in favour of reaching, quote, fair conclusions. But we need the judges to be honest about their attitude so that we as a society, and also as a community of legal scholars, can comment on those principles. This sort of honesty, as opposed to the obfuscation of Lord Justice Chadwick, can lead to the generation of clear principles. For example, the Australian courts have been much clearer. President of the Court Kirby in Bryson and Bryant in 1992 in New South Wales, for example, where his lordship held, it is important that the, quote, brave new world of unconscionability should not lead the court back to family property law of 20 years ago by the back door, with a preoccupation with contributions, particularly financial contributions. Nor should those who have provided women's work over their adult lifetime be told condescendingly by a mostly male judiciary that their services must be regarded as freely given labour, only or catalogued as attributable solely to a rather one way and quaintly described love and affection when property interests come to be distributed. The court must make their intentions clear if equity is to work at all. This is something I discuss in detail in my essay, Equity, Individualisation and Social Justice, which you can find a link to on my website. It's published in 2004, New Perspectives on Property Law, Human Rights and the Home. Now, it's possible also to have a social justice analysis of these cases. Rather than conceive of social justice purely rhetorically, I would suggest that it's possible to create a model of social justice which allows us usefully to measure the way in which the legal system allocates rights in the home. Principally, this discussion will be concerned with David Miller's model of social justice, published in his book Social Justice from 1976. It divides into three parts: rights, deserts, and needs. Rights are the sorts of ideas we find in Rosset. You are entitled to receive a right in property. It would be just to do so because you have contributed the purchase price of property, or an express trust has been declared in your favour, or you've entered into a contract for the sale of land or something of that sort. A legal right has been created. By contrast, we might say that you should be granted your right in circumstances where you deserve it. So, for example, with proprietary estoppel, where you are granted rights on the basis of detrimental reliance on a representation, for example, read Basham, or you might acquire merely financial compensation, as in Jennings and Rice, or you may get a mixture of the two, like in Gillett and Holt. So what we're saying there is, where you have performed detrimental reliance, the court may decide that you deserve anything ranging from financial compensation right the way through to entire ownership of the land. What's problematic about this idea of desert, however, is the problem of a mostly male judiciary deciding what they think women deserve. Remember what we just said about Lord Denning. The third way of thinking about socially just conclusions is on the basis of needs. Cases like Baker and Baker, where we give the claimant in that case the money he needed to provide him with sheltered accommodation. Contexts like child law, for example, where under Section 1 of the Children Act we might look to the welfare of the child as being paramount. Now, this separation in principle demonstrates a need to understand the philosophy which we're seeking to prosecute here. A rights-based conception of a just conclusion, which awards rights and property solely on the basis of some recognised pre-existing entitlement, such as contribution to the purchase price of property or purchase of the property outright and receipt by way of conveyance and so forth. By contrast, an approach based on deserts is concerned to allocate an equitable interest in the home on the basis that the claimant has contributed something, the denial of which would cause her to be hard done by. That is itself the thing which means she deserves to be compensated. There is a problem here, of course, in deciding what we consider to be deserving behaviour, as I said. By contrast, again, a needs approach focuses on the condition of the claimant's life and welfare, without considering any quasi-moral question as to whether the claimant deserves an equitable interest or has some pre-existing right. It's important, if we can identify that different approaches lead to different philosophical results, that we identify which approach we prefer in which circumstances before we begin quite supplying the party's common intentions, as Lord Justice Chadwick suggests. I mentioned an idea of standard deviation. The age in which we live values the self over all else. We none of us consider that we are expendable, nor average, nor just part of the crowd. We matter as individuals. We develop our own legitimate strangeness, to quote from Foucault. In the Trust of Holmes cases, there are standard deviationists, to borrow a phrase from Hans Magnus Enzensberger in his book Mediocrity and Delusion. Let's just think about who all the human beings are in some of the key cases in Trust of Holmes. In Gillett and Holt, we've got a farmer who makes friends with pubescent boys and, worse, trainee solicitors. In Lissimore and Downing, we've got a cross-dressing drummer in a heavy metal band. In Baker and Baker, we've got an elderly man moving to Torquay to die. In Jennings and Rice, we've got a living gardener with an angry, suspicious wife. In Wailing and Jones, we've got an entrepreneur's young Welsh boyfriend who doubles up as his chauffeur sometimes and his scullery boy at others. In Reed Basham, we've got a selfless stepdaughter. In Hammond and Mitchell, we've got a middle-aged second-hand car dealer from Essex who picks up a playboy bunny girl in Epping Forest. The only couple who sound like they ought to be fun are Drake and Whip, but they're not. These people undoubtedly see themselves as being people, not as being units of flesh. Think about their lives. They've all got their own individual, separate passions, things that make them individuals. They're not units of flesh to be allocated to a legal category selected for them by academics from the University of Oxford. How could we possibly create a single, rigid rule which would deal justly with all of these different circumstances? The only kind of rule which will deal with them is one that gives the judges an appropriate level of discretion to decide what's the appropriate conclusion. We would feel compelled to do as family law does, and to apply general principles to specific cases, in a way that is sensitive to context. In this sense, family law is the purest form of equity. Now, how does equity interact with this idea of the individual? Well, I would suggest that the core of our need for equity is that the legal system has to take into account the needs of the individual. In our age, it is simply not sufficient to treat human beings as just another unit of flesh. Somewhere in the trajectory from Kant's categorical imperative, requiring, in effect, that each person is equally valuable, through to the advent of human rights law in the UK, it became impossible to think exclusively of individual human beings as simply expendable units within a mass of humanity. The following well-known idea from Simone Weil reminds us that we cannot overlook the individual. Simone Weil put it, "You do not interest me." No man can say these words to another without committing a cruelty and offending against justice. You can't say to someone, "You don't interest me." You can't deny somebody else's humanity like that. This is the ultimate expression of Kant's categorical imperative. It's the ultimate recognition of the fact that we cannot ignore the individual importance and significance of each individual person. Unfortunately, it is a notion which makes taxonomies of law problematic, because the taxonomy of law requires that the rules are applied without listening to a plea in mitigation from any individual. All that can happen is that the case is allocated to its legal pigeonhole. What can happen if we retreat into such taxonomies is the following statement from Blackstone on the rights of women on marriage. As Blackstone put it, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband. Thus, all of the wife's property passed to her husband. The rules on real property were slightly more complex, however. Hence the popularity of family settlements to preserve the rights of women in rich families before marriage. I'm stumbling slightly because I'm finding it difficult. Blackstone said the very being of the woman is suspended. The old idea was that as soon as you married, because marriage was a particular category, creating a particular relationship, the woman ceased to exist. She became the shadow of her husband. She had no distinct legal rights. All of her chattels passed immediately to her husband. And there are apparently many scandalous cases up to the late 19th century where men would marry rich women. Because the husband became the owner of all that woman's property, he became the owner of her money, would spend all her money, leave her when she had no money left. And then if later she acquired more money through a bequest or something of that sort, he would simply move back into the house. Incredibly difficult to get a divorce in those times, let alone socially deeply problematic for these women. So what rich families started to do was to use family settlements. As Dicey put it, the daughters of the rich, because of these settlements, enjoyed the considerate protection of equity. The daughters of the poor suffered under the severity and injustice of the common law. Meaning, if you were rich enough, you could have a settlement as a woman which would protect your rights in property. Because the courts of equity realised what these dissolute and horrible husbands would do, and so held that, if you were a beneficiary under a trust, your rights didn't pass to anybody else. But if you weren't rich enough to afford a lawyer to put a trust in place for you, if you were one of the daughters of the poor, then you suffered under the severity of the common law because all of your property passed to your husband. You lost everything, even your personhood. Going back to Simone Weil, that is the common law saying to these women as soon as they marry, you do not interest me, you do not even exist. It's astonishing. Now, this doesn't mean that all taxonomies have to lead to this conclusion. Well, what is important is that taxonomies are, first, locked in time, and therefore not in themselves susceptible to change. And, secondly, they do not permit any plea by an individual that her circumstances are different. And that's problematic. That human being cannot beg to be treated differently. In a chaotic world, it's important to be able to react to change and not to be trapped in taxonomies, into these rigid rules. Simply reading the rules out of a big book of rules requires no more brains than does filling a kettle. It's designing those rules and being capable of applying those principles suitably to any given set of facts which requires more subtle thought. We have turned from the law of restitution in these lectures, with its difficulties over words like unjust and its taxonomies, into the law of restitution of unjust enrichment, the law of unjust enrichment, the concept of analogy with mistake, and so on and so on and so forth. The underpinning concepts in restitution thinking are constantly consumed by themselves until all that is left is the metaphysical notion that unjust enrichment operates by analogy with mistake. We're not given any more idea what it's supposed to mean than that. Truly, restitution will eat itself. But always pretending that it is rational, predictable, and conforming to a taxonomy is just not helpful. We live in an infinitely complex world. Our thinking must be flexible enough to cope with complexity and change. Restitutionists and similar sorts of positivists are still stuck in the world of atoms as building blocks, whereas the rest of us have got used to the presence of chaos. At the most basic level, Einstein's theory E equals mc squared is a proof of change. It is a proof that everything is relative to everything else. Therefore, things are constantly in movement, one against the other. Ditto the theory of evolution. Things are constantly changing, moving, and developing. Taxonomy is such a masculine response to the messiness of the world, the strictness of a test like somebody like Lord Bridge in Lloyds Bank and Rosset, the whole Birksian theory of restitution. It's such a masculine response to the messiness of the world. It's a little like the roadmap approach to peace in the Middle East or bombing Iraq. You press one button and think that all the problems in the world will be solved. It's an approach which has never worked before. So why do we suppose that it will work this time? Part of the problem with relying entirely on perfect taxonomies of law and on the rigid application of rigid rules is that we cannot even come up with perfect questions, let alone perfect answers. Consider this characteristic question of an 8-year-old's maths class. Albert fills a bath with a volume of 150 litres of water, which flows at a rate of 2.5 litres per minute. How long does it take Albert to fill his bath? You've all done these at school in maths at some point. Well, the question is hopeless. Nobody fills their bath like that. Nobody fills up their bath completely for a start. If you did, the water would spill out onto the floor as soon as you got in. So we cannot know how much water Albert uses unless, at the very least, we know how much water Albert will displace. Anyway, when people fill their baths, they have a routine. Maybe they run their bath for as long as it takes them to shave, or to brush their teeth, or while waiting for the bread to toast. In most bathrooms, you have to put in a little cold water first, or else the bathroom mirror steams up. Waiting for the bath to fill is so boring if you're not doing something else in the meantime, so you are likely to start doing something else. And because it's early in the morning, and you're not yet properly awake, you will often accidentally put in too much cold water, and then it will take longer to put in enough hot. Maybe you have to empty some cold water out. Maybe the pilot light for your water heater has gone out, requiring you to hop from foot to foot on the cold kitchen tiles as you wait for it to catch. Maybe in your wandering early morning mindset, you put in too much hot. Maybe you just get into the bath when it's neither full nor perfectly warm because you're in a hurry. Because you've spent so long maybe getting the pilot light going, or simply because you're normal and you stayed in bed as long as humanly possible, hitting the snooze button again and again until you were late. So the reason why this seemingly perfect question about Albert filling his bath is difficult to answer is that the perfect mathematical answer takes no account at all of how people actually live. And this is in essence my point. Because people often do not behave in predictable ways, it is important never to assume too much, nor require too much rigidity in our expectations of them. Rules which are entirely rigid will not cope with how people actually live their lives. And that is why equity is so important. Only through equity are we able to measure each case according to its own facts and against a set of principles based, in all honesty, on contested value judgments. It is here that the confident logic of unjust enrichment theory reaches its limits, because there are cases such as those relating to trusts of homes which will not respond to the binary pattern enrichment causes subtraction without a value-laden concept of injustice to go with it. If I move into your house, have children with you, and work to maintain your home, is it unjust for you to turn me out without a penny? And, contrariwise, if I move into your house, have children with you, and then throw you out of that house you've worked to maintain, is that unjust too? There is no perfect answer to either question. All that we can do is to be honest about the way in which we answer these questions. We must make value judgments, but we must make them openly and debate them openly. To do anything else would be inhuman. To do anything else would be to believe that the law which governs this area is simply magic and nothing for which we are morally responsible. That's the end of this part of this lecture. And I move on now to think more about this idea of rationality and whether or not we can actually identify it in our property law.